Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claus. Enjoy.
Ambassador Lissinger was recently appointed to lead the work within the Swedish government on preparations for a high-level meeting on the commemoration for the first UN conference on the human environment that took place in Stockholm in 1972. She was the lead negotiator for Sweden and the European Union in the UN climate change process, and earlier on in the field of chemicals and waste. She was the European Union's lead negotiator on climate finance in the period after Paris. She has also had roles as Conference of the Parties president for the 7th Stockholm Convention and for the 3rd Ministerial Meeting on Integrated Chemicals Policy. Ambassador Lissinger is thus singularly qualified to speak to our audience on climate change issues, perhaps the most important global challenge we face today. Ambassador, we're delighted to have you as our guest for today's Global Governance Podcast. Perhaps we can start the conversation by asking you to summarize for us where we stand on the climate change debate and the underlying environmental discourse, with emissions continuing to rise after the 2015 Paris Agreement, and with scientists increasingly alarmed as the years go by on account of inadequate policy actions that will meaningfully put emissions on a downward trajectory. What are your main concerns today?
Thank you so much for inviting me and for the question. I think it's a big question, and with the IPCC report just presented to us, we all see more than ever before, I think, the importance of immediate actions. And I would maybe say that is one of my biggest concerns. I think we see a lot of things happening in society. We see the transitioning ongoing in several sectors, but we don't at all see the change happening in the scale and in the speed that it would need to correspond to the science. I would also maybe add to that when it comes to concerns that while I think we see a lot of things happening both on policy level with more and more governments taking decisions on climate law, climate policy, more and more business being the front runners for actions. At the same time, we are still maybe lacking that deep discussion on what kind of systematic shifts we need in our economic systems, in the way we produce, consume commodities.
Thank you for sharing those insights, Ambassador Lissinger, which seem to highlight that, yes, we have made some progress in some areas. You see governments increasingly energized about climate change, but as you put it yourself, we are still lacking in perhaps immediate actions to allow us to make a difference in terms of emissions. At the New Shape Forum in Stockholm, organized by the Global Challenges Foundation last October, where you and I first met, you spoke about Stockholm Plus 50 and its main focus areas, which, as you mentioned, includes strengthening implementation of various climate change commitments, and also creating greater awareness of the intergenerational dimension of climate change, which it seems to me links up nicely to the concept of sustainable economic development, which the Nordic countries have spearheaded in recent decades and have shown remarkable leadership on. Could you please tell us more about Stockholm Plus 50 and its main objectives?
Stockholm Plus 50, or the longer title, which I actually prefer to use, A Healthy Planet for the Prosperity of All, Our Responsibility Our Opportunity is in a way exactly about this. It's about creating a healthy planet, doing so, leaving no one behind. So that's where the prosperity for all come in. And doing so with, I think, recognizing with a greater sense of urgency the responsibilities that we have in fulfilling our existing commitments. But it's also, and I think even more important, about looking at the opportunities that we have in transitioning towards a 1.5 nature positive and zero pollutions. And I would also maybe describe it with three words in the way of it's being an opportunity for a point of serious self-reflection. And I think this is something that quite nicely come in the context of a commemoration of the first UN meeting 50 years ago. So it is an opportunity to commemorate, to reflect on not just are we doing things fast enough, but are we doing the right things? And what are the more systematic changes that we need to see happen, which I was also talking about before. Stockholm Plus 50 is also about connecting. And I would say here, connecting different agendas. I have my background in climate, in pollution, maybe less so in biodiversity, but I was kind of always amazed with moving from, you know, one arena to another, how little the synergies between them were discussed. So I think with a Stockholm Plus 50, it is an opportunity to look at the nexus between pollution, biodiversity, and climate change. It's also about connecting in the sense of connecting different parts of society, different parts of stakeholders in a kind of networked multilateralism, in the sense of looking at the contributions from civil society and integrating them, I think, even more to the discussions and decisions on policy. It's about connecting, as you also mentioned earlier, the youth with the sometimes referred to elder generation, but having that intergenerational discussion. And it's also about accelerating actions here and now. So that would, I think, be my short description of what is Stockholm Plus 50 really about.
Thank you, Johanna. That's a very interesting response. And your reference to the leaving no one behind principle, which I think, as you know, is firmly embedded in the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN, leads me to my next question in a nice way. In which ways would you say that the pandemic has impacted our perception of policy priorities and the challenges ahead? You know, as an economist, I have been recently arguing that COVID-19 has exposed our misplaced expenditure priorities across the world. We're spending too much money subsidizing energy. By this, I mean carbon, gasoline, natural gas, electricity, and not preparing our public health infrastructures for something like COVID or its future equivalents. Our concepts of national security are unduly focused on the military and weapons readiness rather than in that which is more directly linked to human welfare and well-being. What, in your opinion, are some of the main lessons we can draw from COVID-19?
I think on COVID-19, we have seen really that the relationship between human progress, prosperity, and a healthy environment. And we have also seen that COVID-19 has caused unprecedented economic and social stress. We know from the UNDP work and the UNDP work on Human Development Index that it has taking step backs on all three dimensions, on health, knowledge, living standards. So in many ways, I think we are more aware now than we were before the pandemic on the interlinkages and how interconnected we are with environment. It has, I think, also, you know, put even more pressure for many governments when it comes to social issues, when it comes to jobs. So some of the immediate actions in many countries has kind of climbed the ladder of priority actions, which sometimes then make it more challenging, but even more important maybe to also prioritize actions in the context of climate, both when it comes to mitigation and adaptation. So while in many ways the pandemic has shown us how dependent and how interconnected we are, it has also put even more pressure, often on the most vulnerable and often also on many of the developing countries, on actions needing to be taken for sustainable development, for climate change, etc. The other thing is that I also think that it has shown in a way that we are able to, within quite a short time period, to change our behavior, to do things differently. And I think that's sometimes also something that one can learn in the case of climate and environment, and our behavior and our daily habits there.
Thank you. Thank you for making those remarks. I find myself broadly in agreement with you. Let me go back a few decades into the past, by way of posing my next question. You know, in 1944, at what is now called the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference, otherwise better known as the Bretton Woods Conference, over 700 delegates from more than 40 countries came together and brought into being a new global financial system, creating at the same time the IMF and the World Bank as institutions with the responsibility to promote economic development and stability in the global economy. And what's interesting is that these 3 weeks of substantive deliberations led, at least by the reckoning of economic historians, to nearly three decades of sustained growth and economic development. My question to you, Ambassador Lissinger, is, do we need a new Bretton Woods conference that would explicitly recognize that climate change is an existential risk to our future? And perhaps, I'm thinking out loud here, bring into being a global environmental agency or authority, an agency that would allow us to move away from our current approach based on voluntary, non-binding commitments at the national level, which, as you well know, when you add them all up, they are found to be inconsistent with the 1.5 to 2 degrees centigrade temperature ceilings, which scientists have told us are essential to prevent unforeseen damage to our environment and the global economy.
I think this, to me, was one of the most, let's say, interesting questions, and there are, you know, several ways and ways of responding to it. I think, you know, I probably belong to those who believe that we are now in a time where we need to work with what we have. The Paris Agreement, I think, is a very strong agreement. It is a bottom-up approach, and some would say that that is not sufficient. I would say that I think the approach that the Paris Agreement is building on is the one that creates still the biggest ownership we need within each of the countries to actually take the actions necessary. Of course, we have seen that, as you said, you know, we are not in line with science, and we have to do more. But I think from my perspective, it's more about working with what we have and making that work than in times of urgent actions, starting to look at new big structures. With that said, we are, of course, also now in a phase where we, within the Paris Agreement, have the ratchet up process of the global stock takes taking place. I think that will be an extremely important moment also for the Paris Agreement, that parties come together and really utilizing the dynamics of the agreement to step up the actions. And I think also in the sense of climate change being more and more mainstreamed into the different UN agencies and UN bodies is probably also a key issue and area for success. I think it will be also very interesting and important to see how issues such as climate change is further developed and part of our common agenda and summits of the future in 2023, which I think is also an opportunity to strengthen climate change in the context of UN in a broader sense than only on the UNFCCC perspective.
I am sympathetic to your view that we need to build on what we have. I think there is a very sound reasoning behind that idea. At the same time, at least at a personal level, I feel a little bit frustrated at the slow pace of change. And I feel that we don't seem to be moving quickly enough. You know, to go back to your original comment and the first question, you know, the need for immediate action does not seem to be there.
Can I just reflect on that also one second? Because I very much agree with you. But I also feel that we are not going to tackle the slow pace with, in a way, new institutions and building new councils. I think we have to focus very much in the sense of what is the people-centric approach to climate change? What is it that makes people on the street, if you so live in Sweden or if you live in Senegal or in Singapore, what is it that, you know, how do you make climate change relevant to people? And in through the people also creating the pressure on politicians for actions here and now. So I think there's some kind of shift that we also need to go through of, you know, the multilateral level that plays its crucial role, but also in a way focusing on the people's perspective in climate change, so that you start to also sense that, you know, the investments that we do in, and I'm saying environment now broadly, but environment and climate also feels relevant for people. And I think through doing that, you then create a better ground for actually taking actions on a national level. And I think that's where we need to see the step up very much in the sense of living up to our commitments that we have made.
No, I agree with you. I think you're totally right. In this respect, I am very encouraged that Stockholm Plus 50 is actually taking place in a Nordic country, because I think the Nordics have led the way in terms of developing the concept of sustainability, which does have this kind of intergenerational component, right, of the responsibility that we have for future generations. And I very much hope that in June, when we all meet in Stockholm, you know, we try to remember, you know, the responsibility that we have to our children and to our grandchildren. But hopefully that will be a spur for immediate action on the part of governments. But let me move on and let me take a slightly different angle to this conversation. Psychology has taught us that language if it's used with negative undertones that try to find blame and guilt, can sometimes have a paralyzing impact on people instead of encouraging sort of creative change and innovation. I think it's one of the reasons why when we educate our children, we tend to be loving and encouraging rather than to, you know, be sort of pointing out their faults at every single opportunity. Addressing climate change can sometimes appear as a problem of insurmountable proportions, you know, where individual action, what you and I can do on a daily basis as we live our lives, can be seen as irrelevant to the systemic changes currently underway. So people sometimes are overwhelmed by a fear of failing or the idea that one's actions are too small to impact a change or on something as enormous as the Earth's climate. And yet, of course, we know that individual actions matter a great deal. And of course, history is full of examples of individuals, scientists, artists, saints that have catalyzed huge changes and transformations. So my question to you is, what can you tell to the disheartened and disappointed who sometimes cannot avoid feeling frustrated by the venality of our politicians, their short-term focus, and the immensity of the challenges that we face?
Maybe first, let me just make a reflection on the very first thing you said on the importance of the language we use and how we react to that. And I just, you know, thought on one of the very early conversations we had on how do we frame a narrative around Stockholm plus 50, for example. And there's always a discussion on, you know, do you have the one which is the more, a very honest one on exactly where we are in relation to science, which is, of course, a very serious conversation. We hear from the Secretary General on the code red, we hear on waging a war on nature. But we also said, we know this, we are fully aware of it, but if we are to also engage people, we need to combine that factual and serious messaging with where do we see the opportunities, and trying to engage people through the opportunity lens. So I think that's somehow one of my reflections. The other part in relation to your question, you know, what do you tell people who sometimes feel disappointed or disheartened by the slow pace of change? I mean, when I first in a way heard the question, I kind of also sense that sometimes we also have to be disappointed and disheartened, because sometimes the best energy is to take that disappointment and kind of use that for making the change. So, you know, sometimes feeling a little bit frustrated, which I think, you know, everyone who has ever done any negotiations, there are always moments when you feel frustrated, when we don't see that we make progress enough. But I'm also always trying to remind myself on all of the conversations, you know, you have with negotiators in different on where they come from, on a very strong, I think, passion for actually doing the right thing, for making change for climate change and environment. So I think in a way also have sometimes trust in the processes we have. Yes, they are slow, but they are the processes we have, and they have shown, I think, to deliver. And they are often also delivered more than we anticipated. If we look back to Paris, if you would have talked to people 2 weeks before Paris, I don't think a lot of people would have guessed that you would have had the reference to 1.5. Now, a couple of years later, that's all we speak about. So I do think sometimes one needs to take a step back and actually look at what is it that we have achieved, and we have achieved a lot. And then use the kind of frustration that we sometimes all feel in saying, you know, what is it that we can do even better? And how do we do that together? Because I also firmly believe that we have to have this conversation in a multilateral context, but as I also said, bringing it down to be able to talk about the effects of climate change in a way that it feels relevant for everyone. Because I think when it starts to feel relevant for everyone, that's also when you are prepared to contribute with your knowledge, energy, experience for making a transition towards a 1.5 world.
Yes, I think you're correct. I sometimes think that climate change itself and the repercussions of climate change, whether it is biodiversity loss, rising sea levels, extreme weather events, these things ironically might create a kind of a higher degree of consciousness in our politicians, in civil society, among stakeholder groups, that we do need that immediate action, right? In other words, it's like a positive feedback, where as we see the evidence accumulate, you know, that immediate action will be felt much more strongly and urgently. And that could be a kind of the saving grace of climate change in some sense, the silver lining, if you wish. Right? But let me raise a related issue. More than half of the Global Governance Forum's several hundred thousand followers are young adults that are concerned with the alarming situation which is emerging as a result of our inability to address climate change and its multiple consequences, some of which I have mentioned just now, biodiversity loss, higher vulnerability to pandemics, and so on, in a way that would begin to slow down and reverse some of these worrying trends. You also commented on strengthening implementation and the intergenerational dimension and the adverse development impact of inaction in these areas. So my question to you, and this is my concluding question, and I want to thank you for your insightful answers to the previous questions, is what role do you see for young people in these debates? They are the ones who will bear the brunt of our inertia, of our lack of immediate action, to use your own words. And how can their concerns be channeled to catalyze more rapid reform and change?
Thank you for the question. And I think for me, actually, this year of or year and a half of preparations for Stockholm Plus 50, I learned a lot from the youth engagement, from the youth movements, from the youth task force that we have established for Stockholm Plus 50. And I'm still learning on, you know, what is it that meaningful youth engagement actually is. And I think with the youth, I mean, we often talk about their future, but I also think we need to remember that it's also their presence. It's the years that they grow up in and an age which is often, for many of us, remembers as the best age. So it's not just about the future, it's also about the youth in their present moment. I think we have to be better in including youth earlier in our processes. And I think right now what we are trying to do is to look at, and it's difficult. I will also be honest to say that it's difficult because we are working in multilateral processes with its rules and procedure on who can speak, who can be in the room. You have to be accredited and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a few kind of different reactions from I think my part. One is that we all need to do better when it comes to an early involvement of youth when we prepare for our multilateral meetings, to listen to the youth in our preparations, to also learn from them and involve them in planning of events. So involve them both in substance, but also in process, I think is important. And I also think it's important that we have an honest and frank conversation on when we talk about youth involvement, what is doable here and now, today, within the rules and procedures that we have in the multilateral system? What is it that we would like to see happening in the future? And how can we together work to change that, to reach a more meaningful youth involvement for the very near future. I also think it's important that we, you know, and we have had many conversations about this, that of course the youth is, we tend to talk about youth, but it's also a very diverse group representing many different perspectives. So I think sometimes we also need to be more, let's say, humble for the diversity of the youth. And I would also say the fantastic work that many of them do to actually convey. And I was thinking just now, because I just attended the last United Nations Environment Assembly, and I'm somehow amazed, you know, when you listen to the youth statements for all of the different topics at the table, they have one statement. They are representing youth in different ages from all different parts of the world, but they have managed to come with one statement for a negotiating topic, in different if you are from a developing or developed country, in different if you are from North, South, Europe, Africa. So I think there's also something in their preparations process that we can actually learn from.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.